The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega. Temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains. Temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains. And you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Yeah, that music means the Hillsdale Dialogue is underway for the week, starting it a little bit early this Friday because we've got a lot to cover today. Kevin Slack is an associate professor of politics at Hillsdale College. He got his BA from IU, Indiana. His MA, he's an Aggie like my wife, his doctorate from the University of Dallas. He is a Benjamin Franklin expert. He wrote the book Benjamin Franklin, Natural Right and the Art of Virtue. We're so pleased to welcome here. And of course, we are joined by Dr. Larry Arndt, president of Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale are included at hillsdale.edu. And the Hillsdale Dialogue once a week goes into a big subject or an old subject, and sometimes both. And Benjamin Franklin is both. Welcome to you. Dr. Slack, first time on the show. I'm so glad to have a Franklin expert. Is he our most overlooked founder?
I think that he's. I think that people very much like Franklin. You know, when they ask people, they find out that Franklin's the founder most people like to sit down and have a beer with. I think we often misunderstand Franklin. I think that we look at him as somebody who was jovial, who kidded around a lot, who was a genius when it came to electrical fluid and so on, but that we often overlook the role that he played as a political theorist, that Franklin was quite radical in his youth, and that some of the other founders, like John Adams or James Madison, looked at Franklin and saw the important role that he played in the formation of this idea of republicanism that was so central to the Constitution.
Now, in the Hillsdale Reader, which we are using and which we're going to get through, we're going to start with the his memo to a young tradesman. But I want to jump ahead, Dr. Arndt, to the autobiography, because I think his 13 virtues, 11 and 13, are the most memorable parts of that. The virtue he wanted, tranquility, be not disturbed at trifles or at accidents common or unavoidable. And number 13, humility, imitate Jesus and Socrates. Where have we heard that before?
Yeah, there you go. He expands Aristotle's Ethics, which has 11, I think. Kevin has written quite a lot about this, but Franklin preached virtue and was popular in part because of it. And he thought that being a virtuous people could be a free people, and no other people could be. Because if you have to be constrained in all your activities, then the government will be overwhelming. If, on the other hand, you can just live your life, a thing that we're soon to pine for in America, the way things are going, then you can also have a chance to develop the virtues. So I've learned mostly from Kevin, by the way, that he's a fundamental thinker. He's an amazing man.
And Professor Slack, I am curious. Everyone picks a specialty for a reason. What got you hooked on Benjamin Franklin?
I think it was an interest in the American founding, and I wanted to pick somebody that I thought was the most reflective. And this, that the level of philosophy, Franklin is often engaged, particularly as a young man, in conversations in his writings with some of the leading thinkers of the world. And then also plays a major role in politics. And so he combines the intellectual life with the political life in a way I don't think any of the founders quite measure up to, even though that's a very powerful, influential generation.
There's an interesting thing going on with your phone, Dr. Slack. We miss every fifth syllable or so. I'm not sure what that is, if you're on a speaker or walking around, but I hate to lose even a syllable here. Would you give the quick, for the Steelers fans out there, would you tell them a little bit about Franklin's background? Because it's unusual and formative. And Philadelphia matters a lot in this, too.
Yes. That Franklin, as a young man, right, grows up in Boston, and there he comes into contention with the Puritan leaders in the church that he associates with the Massachusetts General Court, the political rulers there. And so as a young man, he's a genius, and he feels constrained, and so he begins to challenge them, right? He describes this in the autobiography. To the point where he ends up leaving the town, stowing away. He breaks an indentured contract with his brother, and he leaves to go to Philadelphia. And there, it's like a breath of fresh air. And so he leaves briefly to go to London. He thinks he's going to obtain printing materials. He's encouraged to do so by the governor, only to realize that he has been betrayed. He lands in London to find out that the governor, Keith, has no credit to give, and so he's stranded in London. There he learns his trade as a printer. He comes back to Philadelphia, and he starts to work his way up as a citizen of Philadelphia, as a printer, a journeyman printer, and then he establishes himself in the community. He begins to establish all these private associations. Right, we have the subscription library, the Junto, which he describes as this association that's key for the development of morals and philosophy in the colonies. And then he takes on this political role. He's able to retire at the age of 42 because of the virtues that he describes. And then he leads in the defense of the province. So in 1748, he writes this essay, Plain Truth, to try to mobilize an extra legal militia to defend the province as part of King George's War. He also is one of the founders of education in Philadelphia, as well as playing a key role in the establishment of the hospital. So he's this central figure in Pennsylvania politics. He's elected to the assembly in 1751 and becomes the leader of the popular party in the Pennsylvania legislature, and there conflicts with the proprietors. And it's there that he formulates many of these arguments of social contract, the idea of the natural equality and liberty of the citizens and their right to rule only by consent, and then is able to becomes a key player in articulating those views that become central to the American Revolution. For example, James Madison would say that the theory of the American founding in germ was present in Franklin's letters to William Shirley in 1754. And there he lays out this long argument for consent of the people and Republican government. And, of course, we kind of know where it follows from there. Franklin signs all the major documents of the American founding, right, the Constitution and so on.
He is a tyro, Dr. Arnn. And I mean, when you look back, I haven't read the autobiography in years, and I am reminded his energy level must have surpassed even that of Washington. And to go to London with no money, I mean, Philadelphia's a pretty big city and Boston's not a small place, but to land in London and be penniless and to make your way in the world, and then to come back and become this tornado of civic-mindedness, he must have stood apart.
Well, the guy founded two Ivy League colleges.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, the University of Pennsylvania and Columbia. And I once looked up something interesting. I decided to look up the Ivy League colleges and see what they say about their missions. And I can't find any of them except the University of Pennsylvania that refers to its mission anywhere prominent on its website. And it says that its mission comes from Benjamin Franklin. And then it has a paragraph describing what the mission is. And all of the thoughts in it are utterly foreign to Benjamin Franklin. But that means he's powerful enough a figure in Philadelphia that they like to keep contact with him, even if they don't agree with him.
Well, he is an amiable figure in history. I've been to his home in Philadelphia, and I think, Dr. Slack, you described what is the common understanding of him from Ben Franklin imitators who roam the country at conventions, and we can pick them out, right? And He's the amiable man carried on a cushion chair to the Constitutional Convention who gives witticism, but that's just not fair to who he, I mean, he's so central to everything.
Yeah, I think, and where he's really central, and this, you know, ties into to the reading that we had, is informing the constitution of a people. And by that, you know, at Hillsdale, there's this tradition of the great books that, that we keep alive. We often think of the Constitution as a document or a piece of paper, but the most important Constitution is the habits of a people. And so Franklin, in these virtues, is trying to shape the habits of a people that will really allow them to be free and in the in creating this middling element that he saw was so important for a commercial republic. So the Constitution that Franklin really helps to shape that I think is most important is the way of life of a people that is then going to shape the interpretation of the document itself.
Yeah, it's very interesting. In the autobiography, he says, we have an English proverb that says, he that would thrive must ask his wife. It was lucky for me that I had one much disposed to industry and frugality as myself. He's very practical, Dr. Slack. He's not a philosopher with whom it is difficult to grapple. He's just very practical.
Yes. One of the things that when you think about Franklin's relation with his wife, I mean, and it's also the autobiography is somewhat coy. So Franklin is he's describing himself as being incredibly thrifty as he gets older, and he does admit to this. They spend a little bit more money. He mentions his wife bringing in nicer objects into the house and so on. But what I like about that presentation is that Franklin is touching on some of the key things that make a marriage possible. Right, some of these key practical things, right? Things like picking somebody who's industrious and frugal as you are, or if you look at Benjamin Franklin's wife, helping him in terms of running the store and encouraging Franklin, propping him up for the printing business, opposed to some very, very romantic notion, right, that might sound good in the short term but might cost you in the long run.
Yeah, this is not Jane Austen stuff. Dr. Arndt, I'm curious about watching young men and women interact with Franklin for the first time. How has that changed much? Do they marvel at him?
Well, we work in a really weird place, and so they're disposed to like old things or to take interest in them at least. Franklin is, I'll talk about my own case, but I see this in students sometimes too. You can mistake that Franklin is just talking platitudes. And in fact, I mean, first of all, he's an incredibly sophisticated guy, right? He helped develop what we know about electricity. He did some of the first population studies in history. He's a person who he didn't discover the Gulf Stream, but he figured out how to use it for sea travel. And he got because he did that, the mail came to Philadelphia and New York from England 2 weeks faster.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you this. There has never been a more important time to protect your digital rights. That's why I and thousands of my patriotic listeners choose to secure our online data by using ExpressVPN. Do you believe that a VPN isn't for you because you can use the internet just fine without one? Anytime you go online, my friends, your internet service provider can see every site you are visiting. You think that VPNs are complex and only for tech experts? No, they're not. Trust me. With ExpressVPN, you launch the app, tap one button to protect yourself, and it's done. It's that simple. I trust ExpressVPN to protect my online data because they're rated number one by CNET and Wired, and they stand for my values. So now is the time for you to take a stance. Take back your privacy at expressvpn.com/Hewitt. You get 3 extra months for on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/Hewitt to get 3 extra months free. Visit expressvpn.com/Hewitt right now. Morning, Glory America. We are en route to the Hillsdale Dialogue. If you're just tuning in, we've been talking about Ben Franklin for half an hour. We being Dr. Larry Arndt, president of Hillsdale College, and his colleague Kevin Slack, an associate professor of politics at Hillsdale College and a Franklin, Benjamin Franklin scholar. And now we turn to a short essay that is just wonderful, Advice to a Young Tradesman. And I could tell you why I think it's wonderful, but I'd rather have Dr. Slack tell us why it ought to be read by everyone and why it's in the Hillsdale American Heritage Reader.
Well, I think the reason is in Franklin's view that the virtues really emerge from a confrontation with necessity, and that frugality and industry were two of the key virtues of commercial republic that could allow for a citizenry, the individuals, to be free from any kind of a ruling class. So if you look at those virtues, industry and frugality, they're not just virtues of a industry of desiring to acquire things that stir you from indolence, that get you off the couch and get you to try to do something, right, in order to gain. But rather, it's a kind of virtue of the mind that it propels us to order the world around us in the face of necessity. For example, Franklin would say that fear of sickness and old age ought to move us to virtue. And I like to tell the students, compare that to the later teaching in the 1930s, right? Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the idea that necessitous men are not free men. Whereas for the founders, it was the confrontation with necessity, and particularly with Franklin, this confrontation with necessity that brought out these virtues that allowed you to be free of some of those baser instincts. And if you look at frugality, frugality is important because it's not just saving the things that you earn, but it also frees you from certain desires that would make you slavish. And so for Franklin, he wanted people to be free in mind. So frugality, he actually equates with a kind of contentment. So, you know, whatever station that you're in, you're not going to be enslaved to these desires. One nice statement that he makes is a plowman on his legs. So the average American farmer is higher than a gentleman on his knees who's constantly in debt. And so that moral freedom is essential for a political freedom.
Yeah, if we could get every young man and woman to read and believe this very practical advice about money, Dr. Arne, we would not have so many debt services, and we would not have college debt at the level that it is. We would be much better off as a whole if everyone at least tried to adopt some of the Franklin practices vis-a-vis money.
Yeah, well, and as you point out, a lot of that's fostered by the government these days. You know, our auditors tell us that of the private colleges, the typical one is collecting about $16,500 per student. The sticker price is actually $38,000, but they don't get that. But of the $16,500, $14,000 comes from the government, and $9,000 of it is loans. And, you know, young people take out these loans, and college is supposed to help their earnings, and they, you know, when it comes time to pay them back, they do have to pay them back. They're not dischargeable in bankruptcy. But the colleges themselves are not at risk. If they don't pay the money back, the college doesn't lose anything. And so that point, and in other words, that's just profligacy, just written into the thing. And, you know, we have caps on how much money people can borrow here. And, you know, we give away money like crazy to the kids. But that, you know, they have to develop, because just think, you know, what would it, if you read Aristotle's Ethics, for example, Franklin reminds me of that very much, right? It's a different kind of fellow, Aristotle, but he starts out with the doing things, the things you have to do, right? And if you're a coward, you're useless. You're always quivering. He says once, you can't think if you're afraid of the bees buzzing. Right. Hmm. And then you got to restrain yourself. Right. You've got to be fair with people. That's a big one with Franklin. Pay your money back on time.
Oh, can I read that? I think this is he writes, he that is known to pay punctually and exactly to the time he promises may at any time and on any occasion raise all the money his friends can spare. This is sometimes of great use. After industry and frugality, nothing contributes more to the raising of a young man in the world than punctuality and justice in his dealings. Therefore, never keep borrowed money an hour beyond the time you promise, lest a disappointment shut up your friend's purse forever. That's a combination of virtue and practicality that is rare.
Yeah. And see, it gives, but in Franklin, Kevin's the one who opened my eyes to this. Franklin, you know, Aristotle's Ethics ends with the joys the sublimity of contemplation of the ultimate things, right? That's the almost end thing. There's one little bit at the end. It's not that. Franklin, his own life, right? A lot of these speculations that he made, he didn't start out, Kevin points out, he was quick to want to invent something, quick to want to put something to use. But the first thing that attracted him was just the charm of it. Just, you know, I mean, he overhears these ship captains complaining that it takes them so long to get to New York from London, and others in other trades not carrying mail packets, they get there much faster. Why is that? Well, he just started asking around and collected lore from people who knew about the sea, and the next thing you know, he's figured out the Gulf Stream. And then he says, now, let's use this. Get here faster.
Can you imagine, Dr. Slack, Benjamin Franklin coming at you as a young man? I mean, not the archetype we have in our heads, but a young Franklin, a 35-year-old Franklin trying to figure out the Gulf Stream. And he doesn't go to taverns. He says he's not for carousing, and he's saving all his money, and he goes to the public library, which he starts. How would he come at people?
Well, I think that's part of the fictitious Franklin. If you look at the young Franklin, of course they would always drink. They'd go to the Junto, and I don't mean they would get drunk, but you know they would break out into drink and song. I'd also point out that Franklin, we often forget, was a very big, robust young man who could get into fights. This is a very young man. I don't mean somebody who's 40 years old getting into fights. So Franklin, as a young man, might come at you, and it'd be quite intimidating. I think Franklin, as an older man, had learned how to be effective. And so when he describes the humility, he doesn't think that humility in the puritanical sense is actually possible. He thinks humility is concealed pride. But he realizes that humility is necessary to really know himself, to be able to hear criticisms of himself so he can learn about himself. And on the other hand, it's very effective in trying to persuade people. So the older Franklin comes at you by talking to you. He was very pleasant in conversation, trying to figure out what moved you, and then trying to persuade you to take part in different adventures in the city.
So why would he even write? And I'm going to come back to you and talk about religion in our last segment. We got about a minute here, Dr. Slack. Why would he even write a letter to a young tradesman? What was the prompt for that?
I think he himself was part of this middling artisan class, and he sees himself as playing this role in cultivating this middling element that is key to success in the city. He thinks that this is makes for a better political order, but also that it gives it more power in the legislature. So I think he has this moral end in mind. He really wants people to succeed. He's trying to help them along. And of course, he's enabled by that as well. Many of these associations were for people to work together for their collective advantage, whether it was the Junto, whether it was the fire insurance company, whether it was the fire companies themselves, right? These all started off as private associations.
Well, and the library began as a private. I am curious, though, he does not ground it in his Puritan upbringing or in his Presbyterian faith, which we're going to talk about in the next segment. We only have 5 minutes in the next segment. I want to talk about his real religious beliefs, because I think they shortchanged him a little bit in the note here. But does it all come from his belief that man is good or can be good?
I think he thinks that that human nature is good, but that it's susceptible to many flaws. And so in one place he actually says, right, no human being is going to be perfect. We all have something to work on. On the other hand, he didn't like the teaching of original sin that he found in Presbyterianism.
Yeah, okay. Hold that when we come back. The religious beliefs of Franklin are often wrongly reported and minimized, and he's quite the student of faith, and it's very important to get it right, because he's not, as many people will conclude, an agnostic or an atheist. He just isn't, and we'll let Dr. Slack explain that when we come back. Don't go anywhere, America. Final segment of this week's Hillsdale Dialogue is next. The fact is, the internet never forgets. There has never been a more important time to protect your internet activity, your digital data. That's why I urge you to get ExpressVPN. Everything you search for, watch, or click online can be tracked back to you by big tech companies, and they do it. They match your activity to your true identity using your device's unique IP address. That's why you need to switch, and I switched, to ExpressVPN. On your computer, on your phone, every IP address is masked by a secure VPN server, which makes it harder for websites to identify me. Plus, you can use ExpressVPN on up to 5 devices simultaneously. That's why they're rated the number one VPN by CNET and Wired. So stop handing over your data to big tech companies. Go with the VPN I trust for online protection. Visit expressvpn.com/Hewitt to get 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/Hewitt to get 3 extra months for free. Go to expressvpn.com/Hewitt right now to learn more. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Final segment of this week's Hillsdale Dialogue with Dr. Larry Arnn, and who's the president of Hillsdale College, and Professor Kevin Slack, an associate professor of politics there. Dr. Slack is an expert on Ben Franklin, and so I just would like you to answer what, in his autobiography, he lets us know that the Presbyterians don't do it for him, and he's got a pretty bad preacher as a Presbyterian preacher. But how do you summarize his religious view?
I think you could break it into several parts. I think, first of all, and he gets into this in the autobiography, Franklin is quite atheistic. And what he meant by that was, and again, he describes it in the autobiography, is that everything is by necessity, and there's no such thing as human virtue. This is the position he has as a young man. He uses it in Boston to irritate all of the authorities, to the point where the good people of the town, he says, viewed him with horror as being an atheist. The change that takes place is not just one of Franklin's consideration of people's perception of him, but he actually goes back and he rethinks what atheism is. And he concludes, along with some of the seminal thinkers for him, people like Shaftesbury, that atheism really just meant perfect chance, chaos in the universe. And so Franklin, in rethinking this, and he does this in a series of essays, challenges that initial position that he took. And he concludes that there is a kind of theism, meaning a pursuit of some kind of an order in the world, which he would call God, and that there was limits to human knowledge, right? Limits to what it is we could know about God. For example, how it is the laws of nature, we call physics, work together with the possibility of human freedom. He also saw the necessity of virtue, not just in dealing with other people, but in considerations of his own life. So Franklin then is going to challenge orthodox teachings of Christianity for some of the same reasons he challenges atheism. If you'll notice his criticism of Jedediah Andrews, the Presbyterian minister, he says, "I didn't like the sermons because, not just because he didn't agree with the some of the dogmas of Calvinism, but because he says that the sermons themselves were dry and uninteresting and unedifying." So he was waiting for the sermon on morals, right? That's what he's trying to learn about. And he finds that all that's repeated to him are religious duties and dogma and platitude. The second reason he doesn't like the sermons is because he says they're politically divisive. He says their aim was to make us good Presbyterians rather than citizens.
Yes.
And so what Franklin is trying to do is to reconnect Christianity to moral virtue. He's trying to teach Christian morals as part of a natural law that could unify all the Christian sects in Pennsylvania.
Well, when he says Jesus and Socrates as being his 13th, the idea of virtue, Jesus and Socrates, isn't he giving the game away a little bit, Professor, that he actually does? Humility, imitate Jesus and Socrates. If you're going to imitate someone and it's Jesus, Jesus makes certain truth claims. Did Franklin dispute those?
I think he did, and it's I don't think this is much of a debate. At the end of his life, Franklin says to Ezra Stiles, that he was never certain of the divinity of Christ, right? So Franklin was not a Christian in any normal way that we would use that word, unless you were to talk about, as he says to Stiles, Jesus as constructing this important moral virtue that we've adopted in Christian society. On the other hand, Franklin is very cautious in his criticisms. He usually reduces to the realm of uncertainty, right? For example, he says, "I've never actually investigated these kinds of things. It's too late for me. I'll figure out soon enough," right? He's going to die and figure out. But he's very careful in how he treats Christianity, I would say, in the middling and the later part of his life, because he realizes that there's something Christianity really offers to modern society, particularly in its form of charity and goodwill. Christianity, Franklin, connects to this notion of a desire to understand God in the laws of nature, as well as a more peaceful understanding of commercial trade that he thinks is superior to the ancient mode. So Christianity, for him, provides a superior moral virtue in its notions of equality and charity one to another in society. Whether Franklin was an Orthodox Christian, I don't think so.
So, Dr. Arndt, we're going to have to impose upon Professor Slack again next week. I hope that won't be upsetting to you. But, I mean, we have barely scratched. We haven't done his political theory yet, right? We're just sort of covering the man.
Okay. That's okay.
If
Kevin's willing.
If he is willing? I'm glad to hear that, because I don't know how you teach or even expose people to Benjamin Franklin in one Hillsdale dialogue, and so we'll pick up there. But what would you recommend outside of the reader as the dispositive example of his political thinking, Professor Slack?
Well, I mean, there are some of Franklin's major writings with the 1751 observations. In 1760, he writes the Canada pamphlet. Those are two of the writings.
Okay, we will add those.
Real quick, I will say the three letters to William Shirley of 1754, they're reprinted in 1766 as part of this colonial argument for consent after the Stamp Act.
Okay, the three letters to William Shirley, the 1751 observations and the Canada something. We'll be back to them. Dr. Larry Arndt, president of Hillsdale College, Professor Slack, thank you both. Hillsdale.edu for all things Hillsdale, America. And we'll be back on Ben Franklin and wrap him up next week on the next Hillsdale Dialogue.